Have you seen Chuck Norris lately? He's still kicking butt and staying active well into his 80s. What's even more shocking is he looks more jacked than ever and seems to have more energy than guys half his age. And it's all thanks to Morning Kick, a revolutionary new daily drink from Roundhouse Provisions that combines ultra-potent greens like spirulina and kale with probiotics, prebiotics, collagen, and even ashwagandha. Just mix with water, stir, and enjoy. Unlike other green drinks out there, this one tastes exactly like strawberry lemonade and has hundreds of five-star reviews. Go to roundhouseprovisions.com/save44 for up to 44% off your regular priced order. Plus, every purchase is backed by a 90-day money-back guarantee. So if you want to experience smoother digestion, a boost of energy, and just an overall healthier body, then go to roundhouseprovisions.com/save44 today. These statements have not been evaluated by the Food and Drug Administration. This product is not intended to diagnose, treat, cure, or prevent any disease. Results can vary.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger. For thousands of appetizing ingredients that inspire countless mouthwatering meals. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week and up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with points. So you can get big flavors and big savings. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Hey everyone, it's Yas here, and I'm calling today with a little favor to ask. Over the recent weeks and months, I've had loads of you get in touch with some great questions, and today I'm going to be trying something new with the show. I'm trialing a Q&A segment where I'll be joined by a co-host and elite coach educator, Gerard Jones. Now, these are discussions which are going to be taking place every Sunday evening at 7:30 GMT, live on Twitter Space, if you wanted to get involved directly. Otherwise, I'll be releasing them here every Wednesday on the Coaches Network podcast. So for today's format, it's slightly different, and for around about 30 minutes, each discussion will be dedicated to a question that has been sent in, where myself and Gerard will be going into some real depth and sharing our views and opinions on the topic in order to leave you with some key takeaways to consider in your own environments. So the favour I'm asking for today, guys, is if you could let me know your thoughts on the new format, and you can do this by getting in touch on Twitter at The Coaches Net. Once again, that is at The Coaches Net. And of course, if you have a question, feel free to send that in too. Hope you enjoy the new format.
The Coaches Network, bringing the game together.
Hey guys, you're now listening to the Coaches Network podcast, a podcast aimed at anyone who's passionate about athlete, talent, and personal development. My name's Coach Yas, and I'm a UEFA licensed football coach, coach developer, and content creator. I'll be sitting down with a range of guests to discuss their journeys, their life lessons, and how you can make an impact. Enjoy.
Deep diving straight into the topics of practice spectrum. Where does your mind take you to straight away? Conscious, obviously, mentioned there.
Yes, straight away, I'm in. Where does the activity sit, right? Where are we placing it? So if we think of a spectrum from one end to another, and typically there's this dualism right now, and we have to be careful of dualisms, where at one end of the spectrum, we've got isolated activities that are very prescriptive, perhaps focus more, let's say, unopposed work or non-game form activities, game form related. And then on the other end of the spectrum, you've probably got more game-like, game form representative environment perspective. And when I think about that spectrum, and we talk about this even on the UEFA-C courses or what have you, where there's a similar sort of spectrum of, you know, you could be in this sort of bucket, or the more you go towards representative, you're talking about numbers and games and, you know, whether it's equal or odd numbers and that type of thing. When I think about the spectrum and I think about, you know, let's just talk about even simply, you've got to the left, let's say, drillish type activities that don't involve any pressure or threat to the ball. And nothing changes within the environment. So the environment's quite stable. There's no variability. So with there being no real changes, it's hinting that there's no necessary need for me to search information. I'm prescribing an ideal technique of how to perform something. On the other end of that extreme is that there's no ideal technique, but that players are in a game-contested environment where there's a threat on the ball and they have to figure it out and they're going to have to adapt every time and the scenario is different. And if you're to go slightly close to the left, but maybe perhaps a little bit in the middle, maybe there's a time where, you know, you could do some stuff where it's not necessarily a pose. And by an opposed practice, you know, my meaning and definition of that would be that there's a threat of some kind on the ball. So, you know, we're trying to contest the ball. There's some kind of defender or pressure on the ball. Well, let's say there isn't. It's unopposed, meaning that there is none. But there's lots of interference. There's lots of contextual interference. So an example of that might be that we're working on our passing and receiving, and we're working on our habits of back foot takes and front foot takes, and we're passing, and we're doing that sort of movement, but we're doing it in an environment where there's multiple balls and everyone's trying to move around the same space. So it's a little bit chaotic, and they've got to find ways to find their partner or whoever and connect passes without bumping into each other or ball hitting a ball. Well, now you're working on an isolated moment or a player action of passing and receiving, and you're working on those sort of habits of whether I take with a front foot take or a back foot take or, you know, the type of pass, but it's forever changing and there's lots of interference, which is going to influence the time of when I release that ball, how I release the ball and where I go next, because the environment's changing. You know, it could be as simple as dribbling in an activity where there's multiple players driving around a space, but again, it's not opposed with a defender, but there's perhaps other interference of some kind. You know, those are examples. You could have other types of unopposed work that has an interference. So anything that's impeding that sort of time and space perception, that could be where I'm trying to get it as realistic as possible or as representative as possible to what they would likely see in a real environment, but I'm perhaps working on other stuff. And then as you sort of go down towards more the right, perhaps you're going into sort of full pressure and numbers, and then you might go into odds and even type numbers in games and games within games. So that's where my mind goes when I think of that practice spectrum. And interestingly, if you were to put it to a vote, where would that needle, if you were to say, where is your default behaviour go, where would your needle go? And that's where I think it's quite curious to start the conversation, Yaz, is like, even you know, if you were to ask, based on the last activity you did, whenever you last coach, and even your bias, where would your needle go along that spectrum? Would you be more to the right? Would you be more to the left? Would you be somewhere in the middle? Does it depend? And if it depends, why does it depend? So this is the curiosity that, you know, it's going to be an interesting conversation.
100%, I think it's spot on. And I think it's just really good to, you know, like to start with a bit of a visual of what the spectrum may or may not look like, but, at least for the clarity of this conversation. I think for me, you know, just taking on your question there in terms of what it looked like for my most recent coaching session, I probably fit was maybe 3/4 up the spectrum. In the fact that it was predominantly opposed, but it probably wasn't like, it wasn't an actual game in its sense. And I think the reason for that is because I think you can teach a lot of the things that the game requires through smaller sided elements. And then, you know, encouraging greater contact on the ball as well for the players. But I think it depends on fundamentally what your outcome is for the sessions and the environment that you're working in. So for instance, if I was working with a more senior team, an older team, possibly a team that I've been working with for a little while, I'd probably be less inclined to do the smaller sided stuff and start moving to the bigger sided stuff just to get some more game-like tactical elements in there. But I think in the first instance, when I get together with any group or when I begin coaching a new group in particular, I definitely do start a lot more small sided. Very rarely, if at all, ever do I use unopposed practice in a team context. But I think it is important to underline and stress that there is a place for everything. And I guess the curiosity for me is just for coaches to consider, why are you choosing to deliver the practices you are delivering? Are you maximising your time with your players? And is the practice getting out what you need to get out? But more importantly, what, you know, just to kind of attach itself to that is a question people think about as well, is having a look at what my players are doing in my current practice. If they were to make those same decisions on match day, would I be praising or critiquing it? And I think that will tell you something about whether your practice is suited for the needs of the players in the game, what game context. Those are my initial thoughts. I don't know if you've got anything to respond on that to start with.
I think it's spot on, and of course I'm gonna share some images as well in the chat as we're talking, just to help people perhaps visualize it. I think everything depends, doesn't it, of, you know, what do the players need in that moment, and you've got to have a solid rationale. But one thing I would sort of position to everyone is, if we think about the game, we think about what we know about the rules of the game. There are so many laws in soccer, in football, and it's forever changing. You know, and I'm going to share this little quote here, but football is a highly complex, dynamic, and unpredictable sport, which requires players to have to be able to search information from the environment in order to solve problems. And if we accept that as that, yeah, football does change, and it's not the same, and the situations are constantly changing, and nothing will ever be the same in terms of how you receive the ball, pass the ball, that contact, everything, then perhaps we need to think about, okay, well, how do I get players to be better at being more game responsive? So how can they operate within a game? And that requires perception, and we perceive in order to act, and we act in order to perceive. And, you know, I'll throw something out there that, you know, if anyone's interested in more of the research and Nikolai Bernstein, and we talk about repetition without repetition. Well, it's interesting that if you think about a golfer trying to swing a club at a ball, or a basketball player trying to throw a basketball, or we're talking about football, you know, a footballer trying to pass a ball, strike a ball, the way in which that player, their stride pattern, the way that their angle and speed of approach, the way they're making contact with the ball. People talk about this thing like an ideal technique, and there's this correct way to perform this action. But even when we've looked at and we've freeze framed, if you were to film whatever top player striking a ball and their ideal technique, even if you watched it in action and you broke it down, similar to how we did our last webinar, right? When you broke down Iron Robin, Yaz, and you had like different clips of it. There's every time where he's done that, right? And he's done this move where he's cutting across people on his left foot. But every time he's done it, it's still subtly, very distinctively different. The way in which he's approaching the ball, striking the ball, it's different every time. It's not the same technique. It's very different. And the environment, of course, is different. So really, this is quite a challenging thought for a lot of coaches, because we're so used to saying, well, there's this correct way to do it. But actually, we need to get players to be really understanding that every player has their own movement signature. How can we tap into that? How can we create an environment where they have to look for information and solve a problem and become better at that? Because we can create these sort of experimental environments that are separated from reality, right? We can put them in this sort of, it's almost like a lab. We can put them under the microscope, and we can test them, and we can do these certain things with them. And then with the view that, all right, if we break these parts down and we train them really well, talking about practice spectrum now, we're more to the left of like, let's break this down and work on these mechanics, and we can do it in this sort of controlled environment. Then when we try to, the view there is that we're trying to, that'll transfer more to a game. So when we put them into more of a game, it'll come true. But that isn't how it works. Actually, what tends to happen is there's a more degenerative effect of the motor control learning system. The first thing is if we're breaking things down, it requires a lot of explicit information. But explicit information breaks down when under time and pressure. Well, the game's based on time and pressure. So we have to think about perhaps implicit learning. And where's the balance, right? And that's why I go back to that statement at the start of like dualisms. We've got to be careful to, you know, we're not saying two extremes. There's always that sweet spot of where you dial in that needle, right? Depending on the environment, the context, the day you're in, how far away from and to you are from the next game or the last game, what they need, like who's in front of us. And what's the context? Is it a private one-to-one session? Is it a small group session? Is it a team session? Is it a unit-specific practice? Is it a whatever? So there's loads of things that might change where that needle and where in the sequence within that sort of session, if you like, or that week, that program, are those activities and where do those activities link? So there's lots for coaches to think about. But the thing that I always go back to when I think about the practice spectrum and just in general is how can you make it look as real to the game? Because, you know, it is different. We are different. Every learner is different. So that's probably where we need to sort of think about is, you know, years ago, it was very much the sort of constant, variable and random. And the more you add sort of interference and opposition, the more you go and the more you're taking away or adding certain rules, the higher the complexity of, and variability of the activity. Well, how can we get players to think about that as they go through that journey? You know, and how much is too much for certain players? These are loads of things that I think we should definitely unpack and think about, Yaz.
I think you're spot on then. I think there's so many considerations to think about. I think to start with, it is going back right to the top of what you said around the subtleties in the technique used, right? And I think it's great that you kind of link it to examples of other sports, because I think golf is a great one, right? Because you'd say that a lot of the stuff is very static in terms of it's pretty much a set piece for every shot taken, right? And I guess the intuitive thing to consider would be that, oh, surely there must be an ideal technique then if it is static, because it's moving, it's a dead ball, right? But fundamentally, there's the subtleties that can exist in that, you know, the weather conditions, the wind, the direction of the wind, the clubs that are being used. Not, you know, every player uses different clubs, so obviously the technique is going to be slightly different, even if the clubs are designed in a certain way. You know, how considerate are we of those little things? But then if you bring it back to football, you know, you get the same situations in theory. The concept of the situation is there. The scenarios are there. And this is why the game is very much predictable when you kind of, when you strip it right back and just look at everything. It's very rare that we've seen new situations arise that we haven't seen time and time again. But it's the way in which, one, the problem is perceived by the individual within it and the opposition as part of that. But also, the capabilities of the individuals within it is obviously going to impact their way they perceive it and the way they choose to kind of deal with it, right? So therefore, there can never be an ideal technique, at least not one that is taught, unless the explicit situation can be recreated, which is fundamentally almost impossible, right? So I think it's just looking at, well, what are the base techniques that players do need? What are the skills that players do need? Like, they need to be able to pass the ball, they need to be able to shoot, they need to be able to dribble, they need to be able to run with the ball, they need to be able to do all these other things that the game is consistent of. These are the technical components that they need. In any given moment, it's about understanding how they're going to utilize those different technical components, and more specifically, what is the outcome they're trying to achieve within that moment that they're in, based on the technical components and the skills that they've got at their disposal. You fundamentally then get to a point where they, as individuals, will have to decide, based on the outcome they're trying to achieve in that moment, linked to the perception of the situation, this is how I can operate it. So, for instance, you know, use a very, you know, a very, very good example might be a right-footed player on the right-hand side might look to cross it in with his right foot, but if you flip it onto the other side of the pitch, even you've got a right-footed player on the left-hand side who might be a Ricardo Perez, and decides, actually, I'm not going to use my left foot. I've got a skill set that here, which allows me to use the outside of my right foot just as effectively to put that ball in. So that will obviously adapt and affect the way he perceives that situation and what can be achieved in that moment. So I think it's just looking at each given situation, and the coach is being more curious to understand how the players look at the situation, what they see as variables that which will affect on their ability to impact and execute on an action, or their ability to make a decision in that moment, as opposed to imparting knowledge first as a first point of call on what should or shouldn't happen in any given moment. So, you know, I know it sounds like a bit of a ramble there, but I think the key for me there is just how you know, can coaches get into the mind of the player first and understand what the player's seen and then try to achieve within it before looking to kind of share some ideas of what it should or could look like. I don't know what your thoughts are on that, Gerard.
I think it's spot on, absolutely spot on. And it's, you know, we talk about realism and realistic is probably this thing that's shared a lot, right? It's the buzzword, or is it realism? But there's also relevance, isn't there? And how are you manipulating everything you just talked about there? When you're talking about the weather, you're talking about the field, you're talking about so many different things. Well, these are all individual task or environmental constraints. These are all things that will change. And for a coach, if we're thinking about that spectrum and really trying to think about experiences, how are we designing experiences for the players? Are we really intentional around what we want to sort of describe on the ball, create for them? That's going to have an influence on what they see, what's afforded to them, that you know, and that's why we have to think about what does their game look like? What does their game look like? And where do we want to help that player? And realistically, how can we create something that looks like something that they need? You know, how much of your practice offers realism to not just the game, but more importantly, their game? Because I think that's going to influence how we can design problems, you know, within our practice spectrum.
And I think just on that, Gerard, I think it's really important to kind of highlight that. You know, most of us as coaches, especially those that aren't just coming into it because we've had to step in as parents, maybe with the younger age groups, a lot of us are going to have a perception of what the game looks like. And it's really important to stress and highlight that. For a lot of us, our reference point of the game is the 11v11 game at an elite level. And if you really want to go right to the end kind of point of it, it might even be an 11v11 game at the elite level in potentially looking at maybe Champions League football. But you've got to appreciate and understand that, one, the players at which we're coaching are not playing at that level. And for a large majority of us, they're probably not even playing 11v11 football, let alone 9v9. So what does that look like for them? And I think it's the considerations around the realities of the game at every given point. But I think it's also recognizing that within that, those technical components that I referred to earlier, there's still going to be consistency. You're still going to have your passing. You're still going to have your dribbling. You're still going to have your shooting. You're still going to have, you know, running with the ball. You're still going to have your heading, depending on what age group you're working with, what format of the game you're working in, and what in a way you're restricted in that respect. But it's not about, well, we've still got the same technical components. It's about, well, what do those technical components look like within your given format with your players in their game? And I think that's the key piece that I'm trying to underline there as well, because I think it's so key, right? Because if you take it as a even the example I gave of the player being on the wide area and trying to put a cross in, well, actually, that's probably not a situation or a scenario, a problem that exists in the 9v9 game or the 7v7 game. Can you hear me there?
Yeah.
Oh, sorry about that. Yeah, it's probably not a problem that exists in the 7v7 game or the 9v9 game or even the 5v5 game. So what do the problems look like in those contexts? And how do your players perceive that? What level of the game are your players playing at? And I think it's really, really important for us to stress that as coaches, that we have to look at what can they do. I remember, and it just reminds me of a great example of a friend of mine who I worked closely with, Peter Augustin, was delivering a coach education course. And he basically had all the participants drop down to their knees and just basically put the message out, well, this is what the game will look like at 5v5 with a number 7. Think about what they can do at this level with the bodies that they've got. And it really did paint a picture, right? And a very vivid one in that you've got to take that into consideration, because even at the younger ages where you've got such differences in terms of their physical maturity and what those challenges, or rather those stages of their development, may bring to them as challenges. You know, some players might be ready to play in a certain way, some players might not be. So how well are you considering that in terms of how you're going to want the teams to play, and more specifically what that does to your practice and what it should look like? You know, how many players are actually going to be able to shoot from the edge of the box? Have you had a look at maybe where those goals are coming from, where the opportunities are actually being created for your team and your players within the game? And I know it sounds like a lot of work, but I think if we start with intention, I think it's, we had a conversation with someone about this as well, and I thought it was really interesting how they put it. What's the role of the coach? And the role of the coach, the way they put it, and I thought it was quite interesting to take on board, is the intention to support and develop your players. And I think that's key, because you can't guarantee that they're going to develop and they're going to progress necessarily. But what we can do is start with having those deliberate and purposeful intention to support them and develop them. And we can only do that and build on that by having strong consideration for the challenges that they're going to face and the journey that they're on as individuals based on their game and the problems that they're going to face at their stage.
Yeah. Oh, sorry. Can you hear me?
Yeah, I got you, mate.
I was just curious. So, let's say you're starting out, right? We've got coaches who are listening to this that we're at different stages in the journey. There'll be some that are experienced. I mean, even here, we've got, you know, coaches that are in the academy game, worked in the academy game, and everywhere in between. For you, how would you go about thinking about how you design the session tomorrow? If you had to start somewhere, what would be the sort of steps for you in putting that plan together when we think about the practice spectrum, and even tying that in with, you know, what we're taking from the sort of elite game, right, the Euros? What can we learn from that we might even tie into this discussion that we're talking about when it comes to the practice spectrum and where that sort of individual session fits?
Yeah, it's a great question. I think to start off with just linking it back to the series, obviously, we're going to be exploring different ways teams have kind of played across the Euros. And I think that's probably the first point of call. It's recognizing there's no one-size-fits-all approach. There is different ways to skin the cat, so to speak. And I think if we can start with that and understanding that there is many ways for us to do it, but what does everyone have in common? Well, what everyone has in common is they're trying to win games. Not because it's obviously at the elite level, it probably is, but in development football and working with youth players in particular, it's not the end goal necessarily to have to win games. At least the mindset shouldn't be at win at all costs, but definitely support them and understanding that's the purpose of the game to start with. So then ask yourself, right, if we're going to help them win games, what do they need to understand first? And I think it's the concept of, well, we need to get the ball forward. And I think starting with, right, what can we help them learn? What can we help them experience, which encourages them to understand the concept of getting the ball forward? So it's about being on the ball. Okay. So if we're on the ball, knowing when to dribble, knowing when to pass, but knowing when to dribble forward and knowing when to pass forward as opposed to when not to, I think is going to be really key. And I think this is where the practice spectrum comes in, right? And then you start to address the needs of your players and you ask yourself, right, which one of my players are comfortable moving that ball forward? Because, you know, we can argue the case in many ways, but fundamentally, passing the ball sideways isn't the same as passing the ball forward. But the thing that I always say to my players when I work with them is, look, can you lose the ball when you play it backward? Yes. Can you lose the ball when you play it sideways? Yes. Can you lose the ball when you play it forward? Yes. Okay, so there isn't one situation where you're not guaranteed to potentially lose that ball. So why not start by trying to play the ball forward first? And I think if they can get into the concept of, listen, there's just as much risk playing it forward than there is playing it left or right, as well as going backwards, then you can understand that you're never going to have a perfect pass. You're never going to have a situation where you can control the outcome. But what you can do is control your intentions. So if you understand the intention is to win the game, and to do that, you need to be able to move the ball forward then we can understand that there's possibly that element of risk and reward that Minnesota can manage and understand when to go forward and when not to go forward. So looking at it from that standpoint first, then bring it back to the concept of the technical components. Are we going to try and move forward by a passing, or are we going to try and move forward by moving with the ball, i.e. running with the ball or dribbling? In which case, why would we do what? What's the purpose of the dribble? Is the purpose of the dribble to beat a player, or is the purpose of the ball to potentially just shift the opposition? Okay. And then you start getting to understand the concept of, you know, whether to dribble to take players on or whether to dribble to try and occupy space. And I think throughout the practice spectrum, there's different ways you can do that, right? You might have the skills in the first instance to kind of dribble the ball all around, but until you get yourself in a situation where you're going forward or you're moving into opposition territory, then I think it's very difficult for the players to understand whether the way in which they're dribbling and potentially an unopposed practice is actually going to be any use or have any effect in an opposed session, right? So I think you have to have that context, in my opinion. And this is where I say I think it's not dismissing any one type of practice or any part of the practice spectrum in terms of going from unopposed to fully opposed elements. It's just understanding that everything has a place. But context is key. So if you know, you made that reference about Nikolai Burns being in repetition without repetition. We want to get comfortable, we want players to be comfortable getting repetitions of scenarios rather than repetitions of outcome. Because the outcome is something that they're not necessarily able to manage. But if they can understand and experience the range of scenarios that their game is going to put in front of them, then they can become better equipped, hopefully, to understand when to do forward passes, when to do left and right passes, based on how the opposition are trying to oppose them and set an obstacle for them. I think beyond that, you then look at, well, in order for me to start giving them those experiences and start to understand where they maybe need that support, I'd probably start, going back to your question now, I'd start with probably a game of some sort. Not a 1v1 element, probably not a 2v2, but something maybe 3v3 or 4v4. Again, small-sided game, just so I can see as much contact time on the ball as possible and as many opportunities for players to make decisions as possible. Because if I can use that as a basis to work from, then I can observe, one, what are the intentions of the players? Are they trying to move the ball forward, or are they just trying to maintain possession because they think that's more important? Which in some cases it might be more important depending on the game state, right? But first and foremost, I want to see what's their natural tendency. Is it to try and move the ball forward? Is there a lack of movement? Is there opportunities and missed opportunities? And if so, how many of either or is there for them to create space and actually trying to penetrate the opposition? Because if I can start to understand those things as observations, then I can start to challenge the players with maybe some checking for understanding around, well, why did they make that decision as opposed to that decision? Did they recognize that decision was possibly open to them? Because I think everything starts for me in how aware are the players. If the players were unaware about what decisions could or maybe should have happened in any given moment, then they're probably better placed for them to make those decisions. So for me, it's very much starting with let them play, put them into a small-sided game, several small-sided games, even against different opponents. So don't just keep them against the same opponents all the time. Just start with questioning and challenging their perception of what's going on in front of them. What are they noticing? When are they noticing it? What are the differences they're seeing between the opposition players they're playing against? Let them rotate in different positions. Let them experience different roles and within the small-sided game, because that will allow them to see things from different points of view. Once I've managed to gauge a perception with them and checking their understanding of what's available to them, that in itself should hopefully open up some gaps and more specifically highlight for me where I need to shine the light on the next few interventions, if at all any. But if I feel like
if people are dieting now more than ever before, then why are nearly 1 in 3 American adults overweight? Dr. Gundry, who's helped thousands lose weight and feel younger and healthier than ever, says most people are not getting enough fat-burning MCTs from their food. MCTs are a special kind of compound that, instead of turning into fat when you consume it, turns into ketones, which is a chemical that breaks down the excess fat in your body. So, by getting more MCTs in your diet, you essentially flip a switch that puts your body in caloric bypass mode, which can flush out excess fat and calories. And he's created an easy way for you to activate caloric bypass right at home. It's called MCT Wellness. This powerful blend of fat-flushing MCT powders and antioxidant-rich polyphenols is designed to help you unlock your body's fat-burning, energy-producing potential. What's even better is that it's a delicious drink. I love how incredible it tastes. All you do is add a scoop to water, enjoy, and watch as you start feeling slimmer and more energized. So, if you want to experience a quick, easy, and effective way to melt pounds fast, go to KundryMD.com/energy and order right now to get up to 53% off your regular price order with a 90-day money-back guarantee. Again, that's GundryMD.com/energy.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger. For thousands of appetizing ingredients that inspire countless mouthwatering meals. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices. Plus, extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. And up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with points. So you can get big flavors and big savings. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
The future is a hefty responsibility and not one that we take lightly. But then taking things lightly has never been what Hefty is about. That's why we've created the Hefty Renew program that turns hard to recycle plastics into valuable resources like park benches and building materials. To participate, simply fill up an orange Hefty Renew bag with accepted items, tie it up, and drop it in with your regular recycling. That's it. It's that easy. It's time to rethink recycling with Renew. Particular valued resources may vary by geography. More info available at heftyrenew.com.
They've already got the initial concept and they're trying to move forward. They're trying to create opportunities to go forward. Then I know I can now move on to the next bit, which might be, right, they're seeing the decisions which are going to help them move forward. But maybe it's those subtleties in the action and those repetitions that they're missing. So, for instance, it's not the fact that they're not trying to play forward to the person in front of them, but or they're not trying to dribble past the player. But maybe the way they're passing it to the player may not be one that's feasible for the player to continue moving the ball forward or securing possession up the pitch. Or the way in which they try to dribble past the player has just been an attempt to move in a direction rather than the intention to maybe shift the opposition first before creating space on either side of them. Does that make sense?
Yeah, there's loads, isn't there? Yeah, all makes sense. I think you've just given some really good examples. How do you do it? It's... For coaches listening, it's going to be curious to see, you know, where people's biases are for me, because are we just putting on sessions just to sort of fill space, fill time, and run through that 90-minute clock, or are we really trying to make sure we're having an impact? And then there was something that you spoke about, and I think it's very good. You know, you talked about how you're thinking about playing forward and various things. It just got me thinking, well, when we're designing these activities or these environments, we should really be thinking about how does it relate to how we want to play? Can we have a very clear structure in how we want to play? So really, we need to base as much as we can on that and try and think about, does what I'm designing today relate to exactly how I want the kids to play? Don't just design an activity that's meaningless or it's focusing on a very small aspect of the game. So then your practice spectrum, you'd be on a certain dial, if you like. And that scenario, although it might be of value, it might not have a massive impact. It maybe only occurs 1% of the time. It's a fractional thing. Are we going to get a massive impact from this? How can we design activities that are really going to hit the major strokes of what we want to do? And, you know, an example, I'll see coaches work a lot on things that could easily be football homework. versus actually, look, you've only got them for 60 minutes or 90 minutes. Out of everything you've designed, does that really link to how you want to play? So can you be quite deliberate about that? Thinking about, okay, I've got these activities and this is going to relate to the way we want to play forward. I mean, you give that example, or the way we want to press high or whatever it is. If it's playing forward, what type of area do you need? Is it a long and narrow and you want to get that verticality? Is it playing forward in different ways? Do you need a wider pitch? Do you need, how are you designing your field to help you get out what you want to get out? Because that's going to relate back to what we spoke about before around the information, right? The information that players have to search for. That is really key, is the sort of dimension. Sorry, Yaz, you got your hand up before I go further.
Pause you there, man. I just wanted to get it up before I forget it. 2 points. One, I think it's really important that coaches understand that there is a difference between players performing an action and the practice forcing that action from them. Right. We talked about narrow pitches, wide pitches, all the above. And I think the key thing to identify is that every type of practice is going to afford certain things for the players. The question is how well do the players understand what's happening within the practice? And I think this is really, really key. We need to not be confused by the fact that, and not be misled by the fact that just because we see players performing in action, that they understand that A, they're doing it, and B, they understand why and how they're doing it. Because without the why and how they're doing it, it becomes very difficult for them, in my opinion, to be able to self-diagnose and self-correct when things don't go right or wrong. And I think it's important to stress that. The second thing, which reminds me of a conversation I had with coaches recently, they're putting some conditions on the practice just to encourage certain outcomes, or they're making area sizes bigger to encourage certain outcomes, or they're making area sizes smaller. Or rather, they're limiting the times they make the area slightly smaller because they want to see the players utilize the space. And the only consideration I have is, again, for coaches to think about here, and I'll throw it back to you, Gerald, is if you're thinking about putting conditions on your practice, please also think about whether your players understand the rationale behind those conditions. Because if those conditions that are on your practice are not understood by the players, the likelihood is they probably won't be able to transfer those elements of decisions and considerations they're making, whether consciously or unconsciously, into the game context. And I always go back to the coaches and say, if the players are not making the decisions that they would in a game, in your session, in the way that it potentially should or could look in a game, the chances are they probably won't be practicing for the game. They're just practicing for your practice. But Gerald, I'll throw it back to you. Sorry, I just didn't want to lose that track.
No, you said it perfect. You've said it better than me. It's exactly that, isn't it? Because it ultimately, we could just be putting them in a situation where, because of the rule of the activity or how we forced it, they're doing something, but they're not necessarily knowing why they're doing it. And it doesn't relate to how they're going to play in a game anyway. So you're spot on. And I think this is where, if we can have that sort of focus in our mind, how do we want to play? What sort of behaviours do I want to elicit from them? And it's okay to encourage certain things, because that'll represent perhaps, you know, your values and what you're pursuing. If you want to create certain overloads, or you want to create certain situations where they're always underloaded, or you want to create more variability, or you want to reward attacking from rebounds or whatever it is, then there'll be certain systems you put in place to incentivize that behavior that leads to players having to search for those informations, that relevant information, where it's, you know, is this the opportunity moment for me to run and attack that rebound or play forward or whatever it may be. But again, there's always a sacrifice depending on what you're doing, isn't there? But are we doing something? Are we training just for training's sake? And I have that debate all the time. And, you know, there's a question you've said, and I've said it, where we've looked at something and gone, okay, but if they did that on Saturday, would you be happy? No. Then why are we encouraging this right now? So there's lots of good stuff here, isn't there? And It's just really thinking about, you know, if we tie this back into the Euros, there's some top-level examples of national teams doing certain things, individuals doing certain things, solving problems, being unpredictable. Okay, so how does that influence the environments that you're creating? Where now would you really try to place? If we're trying to really develop these players that are self-learners, self-regulating, they're autonomous thinkers, they're adaptable, well then, what experiences are we giving them? Are we giving them opportunities where they can make decisions, that they can be adaptable, that they can be in environments that are forever changing? So that's perhaps the summit that, you know, we need to think about. If we're thinking about that spectrum, are we only designing certain situations for them? Or are we thinking about, actually, I need to expose them more to these type of environments?
100%, Gerald, and I think just a couple of things that we just add on to this consideration is what's the intention of the practice? Where is the practice sitting in my week? Where does the practice sit in the day of the players? Because there is going to be times where the practice is needed for different things. So, i.e., you might be doing something which might have a more of a physical focus on it. It might be pre-season. It might be match day itself. It might be your warm-up. You have to appreciate the understanding that needs to come with identifying what the purpose of the practice is. And I think it's really important that coaches also take that into consideration. So when we're talking about practice spectrum, it's not just about the stuff that happens in the sessions. It's the stuff that happens maybe away from the sessions, like you referred to as homework for players, and understand that might be where some of the unopposed stuff comes in. It might be on a match day that actually the sessions are less about decision making and more about technical repetition. You know, there's an argument in the case for every type of session, and I think all I'd encourage coaches to think about is going back to the role of the coach and the reference point I gave earlier. It's being intentional. Be intentional about what you want the players to look at and explore within the context of your session, whether that be on a match day or whether that be in training, whether that be away from the environment in its entirety. So I think, you know, it's really important to stress that. And again, context is king. You have to appreciate and understand that ultimately you've got to know your players to understand what they need as in, and then link that back into what you're trying to get the environment to achieve as a whole. And a really good example of that was recently, like, you know, as someone who doesn't really advocate for unopposed practice, I recently had a group of players, teenage female players, and for the first time in several years, I was almost encouraged, and I don't want to use the word forced, but lightly and loosely, to utilize some unopposed practice in the context of my sessions. One, it wasn't a team environment. Two, it was a development center type environment. But fundamentally, the key thing that it nailed down on me was that I got a group of 14 to 16 year old girls here who, if I compare that to my experiences and my observations of 14 to 16 year old boys, they probably play less football. Some of them probably don't even watch the game, if at all any. And outside of the context of any training type environments, these girls would probably not have contact with their football at all, which meant they wouldn't have the luxury and the opportunities which a boy, in my experience and my observation, may have, which is they'll have more contact time with the ball. They may go away and do some quote-unquote homework or unopposed work away from the environment by themselves, or go down and play at the local AstroTurf or wherever it may be with their mates. They'll have that additional contact time with the ball, which, although it is unsupervised and maybe uncoached, there is contact points of the ball taking place. So there is justifications for every type of practice. The question just needs to think about is, have you justified it for yourself? And not because you're trying to eat this necessarily a right or wrong, but you've actually gone through the effort of being intentional and taking into consideration what the players may or may not be dealing with as challenges, as pros and cons, and maybe benefits to their regular schedule, if you like, when deciding what the practices maybe should or could look like for your players in your environment. And I don't know if there's anything that you're going to add on there, Gerard.
I I'm curious if there's anyone who wants to share any examples of, you know, what it looks like in their environments. If there's anyone who's willing to speak, ask questions, you know, we're open to anything.
I've got one question for you, Bill, actually. The question you asked me is where would you start? I'm going to flip it and ask you that question. You know, where would you start with this? How would your approach differ to what I've shared, if at all?
I think that the answer to that has obviously changed, hasn't it? Because when I started out coaching, if I'm being honest, I probably would start with the activity itself. And I would just draw the activities. And I wouldn't necessarily think about how I want my team to play or that identity. I just put on activities for activity's sake. In a nutshell, there might be good activities, and inadvertently they probably did create some good experiences for players, but I wasn't as good a planner as I may have thought I was. Whereas now, where I would start is I would straight away think about, where are we? Like, there's so much. I don't want to be burdened by lots of overthinking. Because sometimes there's nothing wrong with just put on a practice and coach, you know. You can overthink it. But as an example, I had to cover the 16s this week. And we had, was it two games or three games this weekend? So I knew that there was a lot of games. And we've also got a game next week as well. So basically, I was thinking about, okay, we played the previous Saturday. We've got a couple of games this weekend, friendlies. Plus, we've got games next week. And we train three times a week. And we're training on these days. How am I going to map it? And what intensities do I want to go after? Bearing in mind that we're trying to get them up to level. So where I started was I just looked at, obviously, I want to know what they're working on, and I was thinking very deeply about, we're working on these principles. I was covering for a coach. I already had an outline from discussions of, this is what we're working on right now. This is how they play. And then I thought about the shape and formation. So we're trialing different shapes right now. So I'm like, okay, so I know they're going to be in a back three, and I know that these players are going to be in my practice. And this player typically plays as a six, and she's there. Other players aren't there this week. Okay, so they're not going to be present. So-and-so's not there on Thursday. And it was all that type of stuff. So not only am I thinking about the physical load and the intensity, and also that we've got a game. Would you believe it? Yeah, there's a game on Friday. Like, one of our teams, game on Friday at 9:30. 9:30 at night. So you've got a game on 9:30 at night, and then a game the next morning on Saturday. And then one of the teams played today at 8:20 a.m. It's just the way it is. So you got that to factor in. So I was factoring, okay, sleep, this, that, the other. We normally practice 8 to 9:30 at night, that particular age group. So it's fairly closer than, you know, the game. But, you know, you don't want to be blasting them on the Thursday when they've got a 9:30 o'clock game on the Friday. So I'm factoring that whilst thinking about, okay, well, then what does that mean for my durations? And then ultimately, like I said, bringing it back to, how do we want to play? Well, we want to play like this. This is our shape. These are the players. This is the scenario. And these are the principles. So this is the main principle and the counter principle that I'm going after. And that's where I start. So whatever the main principle is, and in this particular one, it was very much how we're dominating the attack, because we're very good at building. It's how can we sustain possession in the opponent's half? And when we lose it, how can we set traps to go win it back? We're very good at building through and playing through, but typically we'll force possession in the opponent's half. And with us trying a different shape, how can we? So that was my activity. So basically, I've got my moment, I've got my phase. I've got my main moment, we're attacking, we want to dominate the attack in the opponent's half. I've also got certain principles that I'm looking at. So I'm looking at how we're emptying rotation and balance, so how we're interchanging positions and creating space to lose people. So I'm thinking about my keywords. I'm thinking about, I want to probe and find, empty and fill, change, all this type of stuff. When we lose it, what's our reaction to go prevent progression and try and, you know, people might use the buzzword, counter-press, whatever, try and react and try and stop it because we've got an overload in certain areas, or do we have to defend in another way? And you're thinking about that, and I'm just looking at the scenario. What's the current behaviour, the current problem, and then what's the desired behaviour? So desired is I want them to play like this, this and this. When we've got the ball, I want so-and-so to be here, so-and-so to be there. And it's not a pattern. It's not prescriptive. They can do whatever they want. But the desired behaviour is that we're finding solutions to break their attack down in their half, right? So within that structure, I'm drawing around those players. I'm thinking, okay, well, so-and-so's not here, so-and-so's not here. How can I design an activity? And now I've got my activity design. And I start with the end first and work my way backwards. Doesn't mean that's just what's worked for me. Doesn't mean that's the way you have to do it. It's just what's worked well in my experiences. So I've got the game and then I've worked my way back. And obviously I'm drawing the players that are in there. And then I'm thinking about, okay, well, then how long does that action last for? How long can I do that for? If I do that for so many minutes with a 1 minute rest, times whatever, where are my interventions? How long are, and I just do that all consciously. I'm just setting challenges, right? The challenge is if they keep the ball in this many time in the opponent's half, it's worth this many points. If this team gets it and does this, that's going to exploit us in these areas. And I'm sort of doing that. And I just design the challenges and then run with it. But you imagine on a practice spectrum, and more overloads and matchups. If you used to think about like the FA framework, it would be equal numbered and overloads. It'd be more towards a game experience. So that's where I would go with it, is how do we want to play? How does it look like? Who have I got available? What are the rules and conditions that I need to put to elicit that behaviour? And then work it from there. And then I've got my three activities then. I always have an arrival activity. Now, I try to, doesn't mean it always has to be, but I try to link my arrival activity into in some way where I've got to make a decision whether it's generic or specific. Again, it links back to practice spectrum. Sometimes I'll do a generic arrival activity, which is as simple as there's mini fields and they just play. So as soon as they arrive, they're playing in little 3v3s or whatever, 1v1s or whatever, as they're coming in dribs and drabs. And they're just playing, and there might be a challenge of a one-touch finish, or there might be a whatever the rules are, or there may be no rules, but they're just playing. But there's no set positions, right? But it's priming them into just getting the ball and moving it. Or there may be more specific. It might be a specific activity with, you know, actual positions and related to where we are on the field. So, again, I've always got to make that decision of, where does that, how close does that activity, that arrival starter activity, link to the topic of what we're going after, the mission, if you like? And is it going to be generic or is it going to be specific? And then that triggers everything else in some ways. And that's where I go. So there might be elements within the practice spectrum where some activities, you know, I'll give another example. A younger team that I was working with this week, under 10s, there was times where it was like unopposed, but with lots of interference in the early parts of the activity, in the session. So the first part of that session was very much that, and it was more of a progressive model. And then it went into more 1v1, 2v2. And I didn't really go past 2v2 with target players. I didn't really go past those numbers. Because cerebrally, I just didn't want to overload them with too many solutions. I wanted the players to think about, again, sort of me and my ball and my friend. And I can probably only just think about my relationship and this player. But I did it in a way that is very specific to where they'd play on the field. And then I finished with an attack v defence in the formation of how we're going to play. So again, seven aside, two centre-backs, three in midfield, one up top. So I did matchups in that way, where I had an attack v defence, and then I switched it round so that my starting front three were the ones that were pressing the back two, and my starting back two, and things like that. And that's how we were ready. And to be fair, I mean, I'm assuming it worked because, you know, we had games this weekend and they looked very organised and they won both games quite comfortably, you know, and they showed the concept. So that's how I try and layer it. But again, it doesn't mean that that's the only way. There's probably a lot there that I've mentioned, but really, you know, if I summarise it, I'm always thinking about how we want to play, but I'm always thinking about the individuals of who have I got in front of me. And I've sort of given two examples where one is 11v11 and there's more to consider tactically. So I'm really going hard on certain stuff. Whereas another one was very much a lower division team, young players. And there's probably more generic type activities that went into more of a specific later, but lots of touches on the ball, just getting their touches and the confidence with the ball. And I couldn't really go past two players. Even in the attack v defence, I only talked about, like, if it was a centre-back, the centre-back's relationship with the goalkeeper or the number seven, that was it. Because I think the minute you start adding loads of things, the perceptual information, to try and tie this back to the practice spectrum, the information that we're talking about for a player is a lot. It's absolutely a lot. So if we actually think about in a session, there's already a lot of information anyway when you're playing a game. The game itself is a lot of info. So if we try and layer it and just think, like, why don't I just go after this relationship for this kid? You know, if that's the centre mid in the game, what about, it might just be how they're receiving off the centre back, and that's enough for today, right? Or it could be whatever. So I think there's loads there, Yaz, that, again, how are we layering that? Whereas with some of the kids that I had with the older age group, and particularly one player, they've already consolidated the information that I've given them and they've moved on to the next thing. So it's not overload. Like, they want more and they can do it and they're showing it in action. So for them, I'm giving them maybe two or three lots of pieces of representative info because they can handle more. Like, the bandwidth is much, much larger. So these are all the things that I try to think about, is who have I got and what's the sort of capacity today type of thing.
There's so much in there, but I think if I had to strip it back down to kind of one key message, is that you've started from the game and worked back. Right, you've started from what does the game look like in terms of A, how you want it to be played for your team, but B, how they actually play it, and then stripped it back to identify their needs. So although slightly different, very much similar in terms of what I said, really, in terms of observing the players to see what they can and can't do, see what they do and don't consider, and try and gauge a perception of what those considerations are before you kind of look to kind of build it in whichever direction it needs to go next. And so, I mean, that would be my key message, just pulling it out from what you said there. I don't know if you've got any final key takeaways you want for coaches to consider, but one for me for sure is just being a bit more deliberate and intentional around what you're going after. What's the purpose of your practice? Why are you choosing to? What are you trying to get out from the practice? And is the practice lining itself up with those intentions? How about yourself, Gerard?
I would echo your message, really. You know, if we think about that spectrum, how much of your time have you spent down a certain end? And it's not to say that one's righter than the other, because as I've just said, you know, there's times where you might need to spend more time in one particular end than another, and you might cover all, but you're going to have a bias. And if you're really thinking about, you know, I've shared a couple of visual models in the chat that people are more than welcome to look at. And I'll share another, which is, you know, with it being an FA event, this is online, it's available on the FA. There's an FA framework for their practice spectrum. They sort of show it as technique more than skill, or skill more than technique. And I think that is where, if you can just have a think about this, if we're thinking about the experiences we're creating for the players, if after that individual session or that month-long sessions, have they spent more time in perhaps overloaded numbers, underload numbers, match-ups, or have they spent more time in unopposed practices, and that might indicate why they're struggling to apply it in a game? Or are they spending more time or too much time in unopposed practices with interference and not enough time in like being able to apply it in a game? Or are they doing too much in these sort of matched up practices, but they're not getting enough meaningful repetitions from perhaps other activities that will lend it? So it really piggybacks off what you just said, Yaz, which is being deliberate and intentional around just review it yourself. And I've never done this, but it's something that just popped in my head as an idea. I'll share this framework. What if you were to put a little dash, so basic notational analysis of looking at your activities and how you've designed them and what you, not what you were planning to do, what you did. So look at the session back and look at what you did and just put a little dash next to the activity of what bucket it would fall under, whether it would fall under unopposed practices or more of a non-game form type activity, or whether it would fall under more of a game-like game form activity or overload practice, and just see how many numbers, how many times you've dashed it. And that will probably give you a very notational basic analysis of, wow, there's a particular sort of heavy stale over here versus not as much over here. And then maybe that lends itself to a better question, which is how can we give them a blend of lots of different experiences? So you're not saying that one's purely bad and one's purely good, but how can you give them a blend of different experiences that really relate to what they need?
Awesome. I can't echo that any more than what you just said. I think it is looking at that blend of experiences, but specifically linking it back into being intentional about what those experiences are based on their game and not the game. So Gerard, maybe just a final note on how everyone can access their CPD hours and what the next steps are.
Shortly after this session ends, I'm going to share a link. Please, if you're looking to use this as an opportunity to gain some extra FA CPD, make sure that you complete the form in full. So your name, your email, your fan number, double check that it's the right number. And then, of course, the most important part, which is your reflection. And you'll be asked an example of what is some of your takeaways, what would you do differently next time. It's a short form. It normally takes the people a couple of minutes to complete. But by doing that, that'll then enable you to be eligible for up to 1 hour as part of this series, this particular session, 1 hour of FA CPD. And then what happens is we submit that at the end of the month. So Yaz will be able to confirm after what the time frame would look like. But we've got the webinar in September, and it'd probably be shortly after that that we would submit the completed hours to Middlesex FA. And then it normally takes between, 2 to 4 weeks, maybe sometimes more, sometimes sooner, but roughly around a few weeks before it's reflected and added onto your fan profile.
Yeah, so just to clarify on that, the hours are available to access until the end of the calendar month, at which point that we put in, once they have been submitted at the end of the calendar month, there'll be about a four-week turnaround period before they're applied onto your fan accounts. And just a heads up for anyone that's mentioned anything about outstanding hours from previous spaces. There was some that fell through the cracks during April and June. So anything that gets processed from this point onwards, they'll get thrown into that mix as well. So just a clarification on that. But yeah, Gerard, it's been a pleasure, man. Really excited for one tonight. I know you've definitely given me a lot of food for thought. Looking forward to you back next week. But guys, make sure you're following us. Make sure you're tuning into everything that we're doing, following myself and Gerard. And if you haven't caught the whole conversation here, not worry. You can catch it on the Coaches Network podcast. And your CPD, as long as you complete that reflection form within this calendar month, you'll be accessible for that too. Gerard, until next week, man. Take care.
Well, there you have it, guys. Another episode of the Coaches Network podcast, where our aim is to bring the world of athlete, talent, and personal development together to just one platform. And you can help us with that mission right now by sharing this episode or any of your favorite episodes with everyone that you can think of. You can tag us in those mentions as well on Instagram at The Coaches Network or on Twitter at The Coaches Net. We look forward to hearing from you. Let us know what you thought about today's episode. And until next time, guys, take care.
mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger. For thousands of appetizing ingredients that inspire countless mouthwatering meals. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week, and up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with points. So you can get big flavors and big savings. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply. At Kroger Pharmacy, CARE is making it easy to get vaccinated. CARE is helping you stay protected from flu, COVID, and RSV. Seasonal vaccines are available 7 days a week with evening hours. CARE is giving you a shot at staying healthy this season. Walk in whenever is best and get multiple vaccines in one visit at your local Kroger Pharmacy. So come and get the protection you need while protecting those around you. Kroger Health, a world of care, is in store. Visit Kroger.com/vaccines for more. Restrictions and exclusions apply. See site for details.